This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Nationalism, Race, and Gender in America, our topic in this portion of the program. Our guest is historian Cecilia Elizabeth O'Leary, author of To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. This is a discussion we began with Professor O'Leary in January when we talked with her about the symbols of our republic and how they were adopted relatively recently. In her book, To Die For, O'Leary writes that until at least World War I, the nationalist discourse was a relatively open process, and the chauvinist variety of patriotism associated with my country, right or wrong, was an important but not predominant tendency. Cecilia O'Leary is an assistant professor of history at the California State University, Monterey Bay. She's also co-director of the Oral History and Community Memory Institute at California State. Listeners, I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Professor O'Leary, good afternoon. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Talk with us first about what it meant to be patriotic in the early days of the Republic.
Okay. Before the Civil War, like back in the colonial times?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, what it meant was not patriotic to a nation, but instead, and in fact, after the Revolution, you'll see this in the early debates, people thought of being patriotic to their individual states. There wasn't a sense that really there was that you were a member of an overall nation. And in fact, the whole idea of the United States gives priority to the states coming around to unite, not the priority that we now have today, which is on the focus of the United States being a singular entity. When that term was first developed, it was really about a loosely united set of states. So patriotism really had a lot to do with first wanting, of course, to overthrow the British, but then secondly, as nationalism, then the challenge of nationalism faces this new nation, you really find allegiance first being at the core of state and local identity, and it's really not until the Civil War that you really have forged a cultural sense of belonging to one country.
And that's why the symbols are relatively new on the scene. The flag, the Pledge of Allegiance, Thomas Jefferson being seen as a national symbol, a national hero. That didn't come along until pretty late.
Right, exactly. I mean, Memorial Day was first celebrated in 1868, but it wasn't until 1971, for example, that it even became uniform that the last Monday in May would be the day that everyone would celebrate it. So the way that the nation has developed in terms of its cultural symbols has been through a lot of debate over which symbols should be made into national symbols, over which heroes should be made into heroes, over which memories and whose memories are going to become a part of what the nation's history is about. And mostly this has come out of different movements of people. It hasn't been imposed by the centralized nation state. It's come out of different groups who have organized and then lobbied the National Congress in order to get passage of different bills.
Hmm. In the early days of the Republic, when people were concerned about their states, their locality, was political life open to minorities and women?
Well, that's a really good question. Well, no, obviously we had slavery. I mean, immediately this nation is born into a contradiction, which is it's born into freedom and slavery. So in its very foundings, you have a racialization where black people are considered not fully human. So that's immediately set up. You have women who are denied suffrage. Mm-hmm. They have no right to be participating. You have people like Benjamin Franklin, who was worrying about the racial complexion of the country and was concerned that Germans were not white enough, which is so interesting to us, the generations that have gone through World War II and the Nazi Holocaust. But at that point, Germans weren't even possibly white enough. And Thomas Jefferson also, he worried as well as how is this nation going to remain an Anglo-Saxon nation? So even though there was incredible diversity in terms of immigrants from Europe, from the different places that slaves were taken from, Africa, in fact, the leaders in the early republic were already beginning to think about the racialization of what it means to be an American. And by racialization, I mean that you impose a color on citizenship and say that citizenship equals some kind of socially constructed idea of what color a citizen should be.
Hmm. But no matter the color, everyone is expected to be patriotic.
Exactly. And that's why the title of the book, To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism, because the notion is that we're expected to be able to, we're expected to give our first loyalty to the nation, even though there's inequality that exists at home. And this was been played out continuously through the Vietnam War, is you're expected to go and fight and die, but then when you come home, what kind of rewards are given the soldiers? And for black soldiers in particular, during the Civil War, they came home after fighting not only for their own emancipation and freedom, but also to maintain the United States. And very quickly, Reconstruction ends. 1876, it's over, The Civil War ends in 1865, so we have this very short period of trying to see if we really could have citizenship rights for all citizens, no matter what race. But this ends very quickly, and then you have the whole lynching campaigns that begin in the South and terrorization and reassertion of white supremacy. So that's a real concern, and also it's true for working class men that go and fight. Probably the biggest difference that was made was after World War II with the GI loans and the GI bills, is that if you were working class and you fought, you could come home and you could get a chance to go into college, you could get a chance to buy a house. This didn't happen after the Vietnam War. So this is an ongoing struggle in terms of rights and duties.
So for the way for men to demonstrate their patriotism, to prove it, there has always been the military. What about for women?
Okay. I give a lot of time to the role of the Civil War in terms of answering these questions, because that was exactly the issue. All right, men are going off to fight in the Civil War. Women, though, are hardly can be said to be left behind at that point. I mean, women immediately, on both the Confederacy and also on the United States side, began to organize supplies, began to fundraise. Black and white women, black women from the border states, black women from states as the U.S. was able to go in and take rebellious territory away from the Confederacy, set up hospitals. I mean, women volunteered to be on the front lines as nurses. But what happened was that instead of their patriotism being viewed as their willingness to, either drop everything and do fundraising at home or actually go to the front lines, and be with thousands of soldiers in these incredibly grisly situations of people dying of disease and amputations, and sometimes having hundreds of men for one nurse to be responsible for them, that instead of seeing women's courage as a mark of citizenship, like men are valued for their valor, instead women were valued for their love. So the whole description of women and their contribution to war got changed into love paying tribute to valor. It was the women and their feminist side who were paying tribute to the men through their actions, rather than saying these women were filled with valor, filled with love, and filled with loyalty, and they fought and should be given equal rewards at the end of the war as well. But when the Civil War ended and the men who fought in the war formed the Grand Army of the Republic, which was the first massive veterans organization that had ever existed in the United States. Before that, it had only been officers that had organized very elite clubs. This mass organization refused to allow women. It said no matter what a woman had done, that they could not be considered patriots at the same level, that being a patriot was defined by gender, defined in terms of if you were a man or not, and women were excluded.
Were African Americans excluded from the GAR, African American men?
No, and that's very interesting, because at that time, at the end of the 19th century, the Grand Army of the Republic, the Veterans Organization, was, and then followed by the Women's Relief Corps, only organizations that didn't have a whites-only clause. So along gender, they said, yes, men, if they loyally fought in the Civil War, black or white, have to be admitted into the Grand Army of the Republic, into the Veterans Organization. But on gender, they absolutely, put a line in the sand and said this can't be crossed. I mean, there was a woman in 1879 who applied. She wanted to test their gender-based criteria, and she applied for honorary membership.
Mm-hmm.
She'd been a spy. You cannot get more patriotic than this. She had carried Union dispatches. She'd gone behind Confederate lines and collected information. She'd been imprisoned and had practically been killed for having been found out to have been a spy. But it was regardless of that kind of heroic service, only men, citizen soldiers, could be members, and they basically denied her admittance into their fraternity. And at that point, that's when then, in 1883, the women begin to organize, hundreds of thousands of women who had been black and white, who had been involved in the Civil War, said, we need our own organization. If we're going to be denied a civic organization because we're women, then we're going to have to found one ourselves and define for ourselves what it means to be a woman and a patriot.
Hmm. What were the agendas of these two civic organizations? How similar or how different were they from one another, the Women's Relief Corps and the Grand Army of the Republic?
Well, the Grand Army of the Republic, its agenda was really, I would say it was threefold. First of all, what they organized around was making sure that there was mutual self-help for soldiers who had survived the war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have to remember that, people who didn't die in this war came back severely physically damaged, mentally damaged. I mean, this was a broken generation. And so the first thing they wanted to deal with was just creating an organization where men could come together. They called them reunions. They'd have them in different cities all over the country. Hundreds of thousands of people used to come to these reunions. They'd set up enormous tent cities. And it would be a place where men who had fought in the war could gain support. Also, and then in terms of their different local clubs, that they could raise money, take care of people. So one, it was just a mutual self-help group. But more importantly, this is a time when they began to organize for pensions. And pensions, are really an early example of what we've come to call affirmative action, where the state takes affirmative action to give particular special notice to groups that it feels like have been underserved. And the veterans launched massive campaigns saying, we fought and died for this country, and we now can't even have hospitalization. We don't even have enough money to live on. We're being forced down to the street, begging on the streets. So they were extraordinarily successful in terms of winning the first pensions. And in fact, compared to the rest of Europe, the United States, in terms of welfare to its soldiers, and of course they didn't see it as welfare. They saw it as their right. But we were in the lead in the entire world after the Civil War because of this massive organization being able to organize to get pension rights. And then the third thing it was organized to do, which is very related to whether or not it's going to get the kind of massive amount of money it was able to get from both Republicans and Democrats, was they realized very quickly after the ending of the war was that the only way that they were going to gain legitimacy as a national organization was if they controlled the memory of the Civil War. And so they really saw themselves as living actors, I mean, who could actually replay that memory for the nation so that the nation would have to remember what it owed its soldiers in terms of the fight that had taken place. So they're very involved in national rituals and memorializations. So that was really the men's agenda.
And the women's?
And the women's agenda was very similar, but with some differences. The Women's Relief Corps probably had 100,000 members every single year through the end of the 19th century. So this is an enormous organization. What they had to grapple with is, first of all, and this is the really interesting debates that begin to happen among the women, is, well, what should be their mission? And their first enormous debate was around the whole criteria of membership. And some women argued, no, the only women who can be members of this organization are the wives. You have to be married. You have to have had a husband who either died or is alive to be a member of this organization. Only patriotic women are women who are actually married to soldiers.
Defined by family.
And then other large groups of women said, wait a minute. We can't do that. What are you going to say to women who hadn't married yet, you know, whose fiancé went off to fight in the Civil War and died, you know, and they served the entire war as nurses? You're going to deny them membership because they're not married to someone? You know, what are you going to do with this woman, you know, who's single? So this became a really vehement debate, and for the very first time, they broke that sense that women were defined by in relationship to their men, and they said, no, women are defined by actually their own participation. What was their practice as in terms of loyalty during the Civil War? So that was their first major debate. So that I suppose then the agenda then becomes is the identification of loyal women, whether they are black or white. So this becomes the second major mass organization that says that we're going to be a sisterhood that's based on women's proven loyalty, irregardless of race. But immediately, as with the Grand Army of the Republic, because it's an organization that has both white and black membership, that's the next second major debate, is whether or not the imposition of a color line was going to divide the organization. And very quickly, the issue of whiteness, or whether being white in terms of being a member, erupted as the next major debate. So first they crossed the hurdle of, okay, women on their own can gain membership, not in relationship to men and family, but two is that, all right, we're saying that any women who are loyal can join, but then there were forces that increasingly battled to not have black women recruited, not give money to the black corps in the South that were struggling to survive, particularly after the end of Reconstruction, against white supremacy. And I would say we can find a lot of interesting debates, and it gives us a lot of clues to how it happened that after the Civil War that really spoke to the finest emancipatory traditions of our patriotism, by the beginning of the 20th century, we've lost any sense that of equality, and that we're back to, you know, lynchings, we're back to segregation. The whole cause of emancipation has been lost.
Yeah. I've got some listeners who are waiting to talk with us, so let's go first to caller on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Yes, hi. It seems that after every war you have something similar with this, whether it's World War II or the Vietnam War, you have a shaping of memory that has to deny whatever emancipatory aspects there might have been in that war. And I guess I'm sort of interested in your view of how this happens, how this happens in our culture. Is it media? Is it academic historians? I mean, what is it?
Good question. What I describe in my book To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism, which goes really from the beginning of the Republic up through World War One, is what I talk about is the issue that you're raising, which is really national amnesia. And that's that memory and what's remembered is as important as amnesia and what's forgotten. And in fact, we can learn a lot about a history of a nation by who's forgotten and who's excluded from memory. And you're very right. I mean, the role of amnesia is very strong, not only after wars in our country, but what personally drew me to this project was that I came of age during the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movement, and I questioned. I thought, well, you know, what happened to our emancipatory tradition? Have there been times in our nation's history when to be patriotic stood for equality, stood for social justice? Or has it always been owned by the right? Has it always been my country right or wrong? And so that really was what prompted me to want to begin this whole investigation back into the different kinds of patriotisms, the different kinds of nationalisms, the different identities of what it means to be an American in our history.
Well, let me ask you, what role do you think that school textbooks have to do in this?
I think school textbooks have an enormous role to play. You know, in terms of, and let me answer this in three ways, is that, one, I think that there's a social construction of memory and amnesia, which means that historians, professional historians play a role, national organizations play a role, teachers play a role, local organizations play a role, certainly the government and the state play a role in terms of all of these different interests and people come together and are in contradiction and conflict and debate after different major occasions in our nation's history. So it's not just, is it the media? I think it's a much more layered process that takes place. And education is absolutely critical. And I'll give you two examples. Is that after the Civil War, the women in the United Daughters of the Confederacy organized immense campaigns against textbooks to be able that they felt like did a disservice to the South in terms of the South's position in the Civil War. Enormous battles over textbooks took place. In fact, Birth of a Nation, which was, you know, came out in the beginning of the 20th century,
right,
which a famous movie, codified the white South's view of what the memory of the Civil War should be, which was the memory was that the white Confederacy had been knights on horseback that had just fought for noble causes, and during the imposition of Reconstruction, that black anarchy had destroyed the South. I mean, this was became the most popular movie of the early part of the 20th century. That was exactly the role of the textbook campaigns in terms of trying to get the rewriting of Civil War history. We have Woodrow Wilson, who writes The History of the American People, where, you know, again, he talks about the valiant cause and, you know, there's no discussion of the emancipatory part of the Civil War and the heinous struggle to end slavery and the whole plantation system. Similarly, today, you know, we hear all kinds of arguments about, oh, you know, multiculturalism has gone too far and we have too much political correctness in our textbooks. You know, I'm sure you've heard these arguments.
Yeah.
In fact, this is absolutely not the case. At the University of Florida, for example, you know, I'm just now using one, you know, example of a school that does have a multicultural requirement. You can take a course on Chinese history, and that meets the requirement. You don't have to take any course to learn the diverse history of this country. The sidebars that most textbooks have in terms of how to remember African American history or Native American history or Chicano history is minimal.
Do you think, just one more question, and then I'll hang up. I just get the feeling, you know, having had parents in World War II and so forth, that, you know, women are just sort of, you know, embarrassed to be disloyal, to appear disloyal to their husbands who went off to war. And
right.
It's just, I mean, and it's sort of natural in a way, in a sense, that they would not want to rock the boat and to appear that they were ungrateful for what their husbands did. And so it just doesn't seem like women have had any real, I mean, whatever women would have wanted to shape society a little differently, say, after World War II, just had really no options for doing that.
I mean, that's an interesting issue. I mean, and also I think World War II, that's our good war, right? That's the war that was fought to end fascism. And of course, in terms of what you raised in terms of memory and forgetting, what's forgotten is dropping the atomic bombs over Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, I mean, and that was the whole Enola Gay controversy when the Smithsonian was just even raising, okay, World War II wasn't just fought as the good fight against fascism. We were also implicated in massive destruction in terms of the dropping of the atomic bomb. We have to hold both these memories, both the heroic and the tragic. And Congress shut it down, said, no, we're not going to allow both memories to be held in terms of an exhibition at the Smithsonian. But so I think you're right, particularly around World War II. I mean, there was a real sense that among many that this was going off to fight the good war. But you know, African Americans organized before World War II and said, look, you've got to end segregation or we're not going to go and fight again. You know, and Randolph threatened a major march on Washington, but before FDR agreed, okay, we'll move towards desegregation. But I think, just going back to, I think, a wonderful example of where women have both been patriotic, supporting their men who have gone off to fight in war, but have also taken radical positions during wartime, is during World War I, if I can just give this example, there had been this extraordinary riot in East St. Louis. It was actually called the East St. Louis Massacre in 1917, where white mobs basically just went through the black part of town murdering people. They drove 6,000 people from their homes. They burnt places down. And in response to that, immediately, black women like Ida B. Wells, who had been already organizing the anti-lynching campaign, began to organize and send petitions into Congress And in 1917 in Harlem, black women, and they were all dressed in white, and it was women and their children led what was called the silent parade. And the only sound they had were muffled drums. And basically what they did is they demonstrated against the lynching of black men and women in East St. Louis race riot. But they held up banners like patriotism and loyalty presuppose protection and liberty. And, you know, when is America going to be made safe for democracy? So I feel like this is a really poignant example of how the women actually took a stand, a very radical stand, and they did this throughout World War I, against saying, yes, we'll be supportive of our men who have gone to fight, but also the men aren't just fighting for themselves, they're fighting for full citizenship rights for both black men and black women. But the women on the home front are saying, our job is to organize here at home because we don't have a democracy here at home. So it's really, you know, during World War II, fighting the war on two fronts becomes something that's a major campaign. But the beginnings of it really happened in World War I. Mm. And I think the women are the backbone of it.
Yeah. I want to get to our next caller who's waiting for us on line 3 in Clifton here momentarily. But I was really interested in a tiny vignette in the book about an African-American schoolboy who said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to say the pledge and I'm not going to salute the flag here in the classroom because I don't know how he exactly said this, but in essence what he said is this flag is a symbol right now of Jim Crow, and this flag does not represent me.
I know, isn't that's an extraordinary example. Yeah, he was just a young child in Chicago.
He was arrested.
Yes, he was arrested, and because he refused to pledge allegiance to a flag, that was a flag that also the lynching of his people were taking place under, and so he. And this was just when the whole Pledge of Allegiance is beginning to be something that is being insisted to be taking place in all of the different schools. And he basically says, no, I'm not going to do this. He was 11 years old at the time. This is in 1916. He's charged with being disloyal. He's brought before a juvenile court. And he's tried, and the judge isn't able to locate a criminal statute to govern his behavior. So he can't send him to jail because there's not a criminal statute. He orders him to return to school. But this was part, before World War I, there was a lot of debate. There was debate among, like, Jane Addams is saying, why, you know, women, we have no rights. We better, you know, make our voices heard. We don't want to go fight in a war. You know, how can we fight in a war when we have no rights at home? So there were African Americans all across the country were saying, there were great debates. Some were saying, yes, go fight. This is a way to gain our citizenship rights. Others are saying, no, why are we going to go fight in a country that's denying us citizenship? And so Herbert Eves was his name. This was the example. He was a part of that movement saying, and his words were, I'm willing to salute the flag as the flag salutes me.
Mm.
So that was the sentiment he was representing.
Let's talk with another listener. On line 3 in Clifton, good afternoon.
Yes, good afternoon. And being a World War II veteran who flew with our Air Force and the father of 8 daughters and 3 sons, I hope that the ladies get their rightful due and equality. And also, I hope that our black people get their rightful due and equal rights all the way around. I would mention 2 things that I remember vividly from World War II. One was the Tuskegee Airmen, the black fighter pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And their history and what they did. Well, it's bringing me almost to tears, ma'am. But it's one of the great stories out of World War II. And then another thing that just aggravated me no end was how some of our schools, not all of them, but they're teaching how bad a thing it was that we dropped the atomic bomb. Mm-hmm. And along with that, how they withdrew the atomic bomb postage stamp, which was the 50th year commemoration of things that happened in 1945. And I'll just put it real bluntly, my orders, I had one tour in as a navigator in the Pacific, flew my 28 missions, the crew rotated home. My orders were to go to pilot school. If I got through pilot school, I was to return to combat. Now, I'm not complaining about that because that's what I volunteered to do. Mm-hmm. But thank God Harry Truman had the intestinal fortitude to say, go ahead and drop the bomb, get this war over. The slaughter had gone on quite long enough. Total deaths in World War II was 53,400,000 people. We were killing people at almost a million per month. And I don't know, these people that said it was a bad thing, I guess they wanted the slaughter to go on, kill another million every month till it finally ended. So, I won't go any further. I'd just like to hear your comments on this. And I consider... I am a loyal patriot. I love this country, but I sure don't love some of the stuff that goes on here.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the points that you raised. And I just to respond to the dropping of the nuclear bomb, I think probably we disagree on whether... those bombs needed to be dropped in order to bring the war on the Pacific Theater to such a rapid end. But we certainly, absolutely agree with the urgency of bringing that war to an end and just the incredible slaughter that was taking place all around. And I guess my position would be that what we need to do when we have painful memories like this, and where we're going to have different points of view, not about human life, but around tactics and their consequences, decisions that are made during war. I think as a country, we need to have those painful memories looked at and not buried. And I think that it was a great disservice that, for example, the Smithsonian didn't go ahead with the exhibit that really would have allowed all of us to take a look at what happened with the dropping of that bomb. Why did some people feel like it was absolutely essential, as you've just presented, to bringing the war in the Pacific to an end? Why did some generals feel like, no, it wasn't? As a matter of fact, this was a mistake that Japan, in fact, had been sending signals that they were willing to negotiate. You know, and was this really about ending the war? Was this about beginning the Cold War? But I think these are the difficult discussions that as a people that we have to face, and we can use our public institutions if they're done, if the debates are presented in respectful ways, where we can bring people who have different viewpoints in, and we look at each other and we look at our past, rather than just trying to forget the parts that we have disagreements around. I also think it's true in our textbooks. It does us a great disservice when we're not willing to look at painful memories or contradictions. To be patriotic doesn't mean to be blind. And I think you said it so well, that you're very loyal to your country, but there's things you disagree with. Well, loyalty, I think, cannot be a question of my country right or wrong. Loyalty is how do we open up to see whether or not we're really standing up to the principles that we believe in. And that includes going back into our past and taking a hard look at it. So I really appreciate this caller's comments.
I want to thank him for his call this afternoon. And we're running down rapidly on the time that we have left in this portion of the program. So we're going to take another call now. Listener in Taylorville on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
another piece of perspective. Woodrow Wilson, this information is available in numerous books, but I might recommend one called Over There. I forget the author. Authorized as something like a private police force in the hysterical fury, frenzy of the World War One period, something like a quarter of a million vigilante types going around spying on people to see whether they were gung ho for the war, and during that dreadful period, Germans could be persecuted. American Germans, quite loyal individuals. I recall one story of a fellow I think was out walking his dog, and he was lynched just because he happened to be German. Jumping ahead to the NOM experience.
Okay, I got to ask the caller here to quickly sum up. Go ahead and make your second point.
It was truly a racist war when you consider the language used, Gooks and Slopes, and the fact that we had preferments, people who had no more business going to college than I might have being emperor of the planet. But come to think of it, it might be fun.
We're gonna stop there and ask Professor O'Leary to comment.
Okay, let me just what I'd like to comment on is in terms of the reactionary triumph of patriotism during World War One. Basically, government leaders and conservative political forces, industrialist corporations, and patriotic organizations effectively marginalized the liberal wing of progressivism. And I want to read you a quote by the George Creel, who wrote to President Wilson. He says, "All the radical and liberal friends of your anti-imperialist war policy were either silenced or intimidated." And then Senator Hiram Johnson writes, "The Department of Justice and the Post Office were allowed to silence and intimidate them. The war has set back the people for a generation. They have bowed to 100 repressive acts." And so your caller is absolutely right. During World War One, there were massive organizations, vigilante organizations, that if anyone questioned what we were doing during World War One, you could be sentenced to jail. If you were German-American, you could be rounded up. You could lose your job. But the repression, what happened is by the end of World War One, the reason why Wilson has no support for his world organization is because he's imprisoned and silenced anyone who might have been in support of it. So that's part of the paradox of patriotism. Again, getting back to the title of my book, To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism, is that so often the ideals of this country are undermined by what the actual daily practice is.
Hmm. Thank you again for spending time with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Cecilia Elizabeth O'Leary has been our guest in this portion of the afternoon magazine. We've been talking with her about some of the issues she raises in her book, To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism. Her book is available in paperback from Princeton University Press. In her book, O'Leary poses some really interesting questions. Who speaks for the country? Who has a right to the flag? Will our nation state guarantee or limit the rights of citizenship? Very interesting history book. To Die For, The Paradox of American Patriotism.